because all the definitions of play suggested there was something trivial about it.
Right.
And if it exists on an evolutionary time frame and it exists in all these species, it has to be doing something really important. Otherwise, we wouldn't engage in it.
Today, we got something a little bit different. We're going to talk about the importance of play. I've got two experts on the subject of play, both for children and adults. Does sitting down and playing matter? What are the benefits when children play, both structured and unstructured? How about us adults? Are there benefits when we sit down and play games? Sit back, relax, listen to two people smarter than me talk about the importance of play.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Now, this podcast, over the course of 100 episodes, has focused on tabletop gaming, miniatures, war games, board games, and role-playing games. But today, I want to take a step back, and instead of talking about what we play, I want to talk about why we play and why it might matter, why it's important. So the first thing I did is I went to the dictionary, looked at Webster's, and it defines the verb play as to engage in activity for enjoyment and recreation rather than a serious or practical purpose. And then when I looked at the noun, and that's so similar, it's an activity engaged in for enjoyment and recreation, especially by children. So today's guests are what I consider authorities on play, not just for kids, but for adults. And I wanted to explore why play is important, potentially really for all ages. So my first guest is Heather Murphy. Now, she's a primary assistant teacher at the Pinewoods Montessori and a leader at Tinker Garden. Now, she's made a living engaging children and adults in education and play. So Heather, welcome to the Third Floor.
Thanks, Craig. Nice to be here.
So Heather, I want to probably start with Montessori a little bit, if I could, because that's something that I'm familiar with, because I had my daughter in Montessori up through pre-K. Okay. Because I know for, and I forgot her first name. What is Montessori's first name?
Maria, Dr. Maria Montessori.
Thank you. For Dr. Montessori, I know play was important, and play was important as far as discovery and things like that. Did you put weight on play before getting involved with Montessori, or was it Montessori that kind of introduced you to that concept?
I first started researching types of children's learning when my son was about to start kindergarten. So I was looking at lots of models of education, and I was drawn towards the child-led style of learning. And there are a variety of different learning styles that can be described that way. But I was particularly impressed with Montessori education. You know, you just walk into a classroom and it seems very peaceful. The children are engaged, they're active. And the things that they learn at very young ages are really impressive. I signed him up right away for kindergarten, and then I ended up teaching there. And now my daughter is at the same school, so we're a Montessori family through and through.
So when I reached out to you, Heather, and you know, I talked about play, and I wanted to have a discussion about play, I'd be curious to know, you know, out of the gate, what is that concept, or what does that mean to you? The concept of play, both for children and adults.
I mean, for me, I think it evolves. So adults have a certain definition of it. I think it's when you reach a state of flow, you know, you're so immersed in your task that, you know, you feel free. And just for fun, I asked my 3 and 7 year old right before the podcast, since they're also experts, and you know, my son who's 7 said, you know, when I play with my friends. So for him, it's a very social activity. Yeah. And my daughter who's 3 just said, doing my works. So
interesting.
Her learning is her play, which was fascinating to me.
Yeah, it. Look at you doing research before the podcast.
Yeah, from the expert's mouths.
That's funny. So my second guest is Patrick McLean. Now, he's the president of Reinforcements LLC and the founder of Rough House Play. He's a professional writer and has the distinct failing of character by being my closest friend for over 30 years. So, Patrick, you've been here physically before, but welcome to the third floor.
Why, thanks. Glad to be here.
So, Patrick, you and I think we've talked about this several times, maybe not as specific as we're going to get to today. And when I started thinking about this as a discussion topic, I immediately thought of you because of the work you did with Rough House Play. So can you briefly talk about what that was?
Yeah. So my son, when he was in kindergarten, they got in trouble for playing tag in the 20 minutes of recess that they gave those kids. So they were forbidden from playing tag, which if you know anything about anything, pursuit games are played by every mammal, like all the way down to maybe all the way into invertebrates. Like it's one of the things that juveniles of all species do. And I was like, all right, this is wrong. We got to have space for this kind of play to take place. And we got to make sure that it happens. And then I started researching it more. And I can unpack that a little bit, but it's just the fundamental importance of unsupervised play, of negotiating across a game, you know, those kind of things. And then I've done martial arts for, you know, about 25 years now. And that kind of rough and tumble wrestling interaction has always been, I've seen how it's brought people closer together, how it relieves stress, how it does wonderful things. And the fact that, you know, when you and I grew up, we could engage in that kind of play. And it there were large swaths of time for kids then that were unsupervised. So you really did have to make the game. And then, you know, not to wander too far afield from your question, but play has this quality that it's like, it's like a fire, or it's like something that's, you know, you just, it's fascinating of it in and of itself. So you work out your differences with other people because you want to keep playing. And that's just when somebody else provides you the rules, like that doesn't have, that sort of interaction doesn't happen in traditional settings right now.
So what's interesting about what you said there, Patrick, especially what kind of gave birth to the concept of the Rough House Play, was the physical aspect of it. And you mentioned it again with the martial arts. Do you consider that an important component of it, or just a certain type of play?
Well, that was a component of Rough House Play, because that wasn't, you know, allowed or encouraged. And kids, and there's actually quite a lot of studies that show that they need to engage in that sort of play to develop trust, develop limits, you know, just to realize they're not going to break. All of those kind of things are very good for development. But in the larger thing that I uncovered was there's just no space for unstructured, or what I would call minimally structured, play anymore. Like I came across a statistic that was half of the kindergartens in Los Angeles had 0 minutes of recess a day.
Yeah.
Like none. Like, yep. So that was really what led to all that.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, that's going back to you, Heather, that's what really attracted my wife and I to Montessori was, now, you mentioned the peacefulness when you walked in the classroom. We were convinced, my wife and I were, that there was some spell that you learned as a Montessori teacher, because it was unbelievable to have 25 children between the ages of, you know, 3 and 7 all in the same room, just being self-directed and everything. It's incredible.
Well, how much time in Montessori is there for unstructured play? Because I'm not really familiar with Montessori.
Yeah, I mean, I can completely assure you that on the playground, they're as wild as any other 3 to 6 year olds. So I just think the way the materials that Dr. Montessori designed, they are set up so there is one correct way of completing the task. And her goal was to teach children practical life lessons. So in primary, my age group, they're 3 to 6 year olds. They're learning things like how to pour from one glass to another. They're spooning small beads from one container to the other. They're learning how to snap down a snapping frame or zip their own coats, you know. So we teach them life skills, and there's a control of error built into each work. So if they spill, they know that, oh, I have to practice this more. Right. So it sounds very controlled and structured in that there's one correct way. We show them the correct way, which is what they're striving for. But you see them doing this work all infinite kinds of ways. And I think that's where there's room for creativity. There's room for that play. And it allows them the space to choose what's engaging to them and then experiment within the structure of the work. So over time, as they experiment, they can figure out what's the most efficient or the best way for them to do that. But they're able to do that through experimentation and creativity. And then, you know, this plays out on the playground where it's totally unstructured, but they're still given that sense of, you know, they've been given the skills to kind of have the self-control. They have the executive functioning skills that are developing to work out problems in a social context then.
Mm-hmm. What I thought was interesting about it was, and the two things that you mentioned, Heather, was the modeling aspect of it. I thought was very, very interesting. And the fact that there was modeling for the final product, right? But not necessarily modeling for the method and then encouraging of the exploration of how to get from A to B once you know what B was. The other thing that you talked about too, which I found fascinating, was the tactile nature, which gets into some of the physical that Patrick talked about, and that it's not just academic, it's not just thought. It's, you know, you learn multiplication by picking blocks up and moving things and mm-hmm. and putting one thing here and one thing there. So all of that I thought was really, really, really interesting. So guys, what we're going to do is take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to talk to Heather and Patrick a little bit more specifically about play with children and what play can mean for children and maybe how it's changed over time. So we'll be right back.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Howdy friends, Greg here. Nothing makes Malifaux easier than having the right tools. Here at the Third Floor, we love all the licensed Malifaux goodies from Custom Meeple. Not only are they helping support this podcast, they sell custom-made weird licensed tokens and terrain. They sell it all. Crew boxes, terrain, markers, tokens, and even a 3x3 full Malifaux board. Custom Meeple sells a complete M3E token set covering every marker and token you need to play. Custom Meeple are the source for the official accessories for Malifaux. Everything is designed by hand and authorized by Weird Games. Check them out at CustomMeeple.com, that's with one M, or follow the link in the show notes. Up your Malifaux game and be sure to tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. If you use the promo code THIRDFLOORFRIEND, all one word, THIRDFLOORFRIEND, you'll get a 5% discount and help support the podcast. It's valid on everything except retail products and playmats. So we kind of led into it before the break a little bit, but I want to dig into it a little bit more. And I want to talk about where we traditionally think of play. So, you know, when we think about play, when we think about games, a lot of times we think of children. And for the hobbyists and the gamers that listen to this podcast, I'm sure it's happened to you all the time where when you tell them what your hobby is, it's immediately attributed to being, you know, a kids type thing and kids games. During the break, Patrick and I were talking, and one of the things that Patrick mentioned is, Patrick, from my understanding, you're not a huge fan of Webster's definitions of play that I used in the intro.
No, and it's probably not even Webster's fault, but it's we don't understand play very well. Play is ancient. Play is older than humanity. Play is older than we are as a species. So the question that I came across, and there's some good books. There's a book by Stuart Brown called Play. It's a survey of all of the research and literature that's gone into play up to, I guess, when the book was written. It was maybe 2005. But anyway, one of the questions is because all the definitions of play suggested there was something trivial about it.
Right.
And if it exists on an evolutionary time frame and it exists in all these species, it has to be doing something really important. Otherwise, we wouldn't engage in it, right? So there's something very serious about play. And what I think is it's the fastest way to learn. I mean, in any physical, like martial arts, definitely. The trick is getting people to a place where they play constructively so they can learn as quickly as possible. And competition is also a form of play. We agree on a set of rules. We're playing a finite, you know, we're playing a game within a structure. But just for exploration, it just seems to be the fastest way to learn. And there's also something about a play state with children. And this has been measured too, that kids will exercise much harder playing than you can get them to exercise on their own. Right. So you could give them a game. You could give, you know, eighth grader, my 8-year old, a game to play and he'd play it. But if you get a bunch of 8-year olds playing tag, they will run themselves to exhaustion.
Right. Right. So Heather, I'd be curious. One, do you agree with what Patrick said? Let's start there.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that makes things less interesting. It's more exciting if you guys disagree. So now we move on.
Sorry, I can be the contrarian.
Should have started with you. One thought I did have, because you've got a boy and a girl, and there's a bit of an age gap there. And, you know, you talked about how you, ask them about play, and though there's a lot of similarities, a little bit of differences, but I would be interested, are you seeing differences in how they play? So for example, you know, where your daughter is now versus when your son was the same age, do you see them playing the same way, or treating play the same way?
In some ways, yes. And in some ways, no. I think no, because they're personalities are different and their interests are different. But I liked what Patrick was saying about how, you know, all mammals do this. There must be a reason for doing this. And something I learned while I was teaching Tinker Garden classes, these are all outdoor, nature-based, very open-ended classes where children essentially tinker with nature materials. You know, in contrast to Montessori learning, it's completely open-ended. It's allowing the children to explore messy things. but they're learning, they have done research, and there are universal patterns of behavior called behavioral schema that, you know, you've probably seen in your children, family, children. You know, why does all the different colors of Play-Doh get squished together? Why do the peas and mashed potatoes all get mixed into a slurry? You know, why is my kid stacking, you know, 50 stickers on top of one another? Why is my child spinning, you know, or spending hours watching the tumble dryer? And these are called behavioral schema. So, you know, the stacking of stickers is a schema called connection, and it's building the neural pathways to plan for the future when children are having to sequence, or plan out their work schedule or something like that. The rotation is putting them in touch with their vestibular sense. The transformation of Play-Doh colors. This is essentially messy thinking building onto creativity. And that's the skill that all these tech corporations like Google really are seeking out. So, you know, next time you see your kid or niece or nephew, you know, mixing their dinner together, let them play because they're learning.
Yeah, definitely. And so, Patrick, we talk about, you know, the unstructured play, especially at a very young age in the pre-K time. But and I think, you know, you've seen it with your son. I'm seeing it now with my daughter. And Heather, I would assume you've seen it with your son. There's that transition into more games. Right. So whether it be board games, something as structured as tag is in its own way. With specifically with your son, did you see that as a transition? When did he start showing interest in something a little bit more? Let's sit down and play a game.
Yeah, there's a whole lot going on in that question. He's started to show an interest in playing games. Like I made a checker set with him and he didn't want to play. It was too early. And then just recently now he wants to play. Wants to play checkers. He wants to play games, and we'll follow the rules instead of just making up rules. There's developmental stages. The father of developmental psychology, a guy named Jean Piaget, wrote a book called the Moral Education of the Child. But what he did is he studied kids playing marbles throughout Germany. And what he found was is every little pocket had different rules to how you played marbles. And all the kids could come together and play marbles of different ages. But if you pulled a younger child out, the younger child couldn't explain the rules.
Hmm.
So what he said is that kids go through, they play the game and they just sort of, you know, they fumble their way through the interaction, which if you think about how people learn things is at first you fumble your way through it and you try and figure out what's going on. You embody the rules before you understand them.
Right.
And then they understand them. And then they get to a place where they can start to change the rules, argue about the rules, change the game. And that was sort of his full development. But what Piaget observed was that you learn things about fairness, the balance between competition and cooperation, right? And all of those things are mapped up into structured games. So they're really profoundly social. Like if you think about, like you've known me, geez, it's 30 years. Like, you know, we would play games together and I was not, you know, the most socially adept person in the world back then. You know what I mean? But a game, because you have the structure, it facilitates the interaction so that you can learn. You can scaffold those things on the game. So yeah, I've definitely seen that. And it's, I mean, it's just fascinating. It's one of the reasons to have kids, man.
How about you, Heather? Have you seen that type of transition that Patrick's talking about where for your son, as he's gotten older, his interest has changed and he wants to play a more structured type game?
I mean, we've always played board games since he was young. You know, we started with little memory card games, but now, you know, to my chagrin and my husband's delight, he has introduced him to all the 80s video games that my husband used to play, like Gauntlet and Pac-Man.
Oh,
and, you know, Rampage. I don't even know. There's so many of them. And now my son.
A classical education.
Yeah, exactly. He seeks that out because it's a social time he can spend with his dad, which exactly. Is great, you know, despite the quality of the games.
Well, we growing up learned it rots our brains, and Patrick and I and our proof of that is ones that have played those games. But what's interesting about that is I remember, you know, the boogeyman of video games, because really at my age, it was really the first kind of generation to have video games. There really weren't video games for the generation before us. And, you know, I'm trying to think of when the Mortal Kombat video games rating stuff was happening. That was probably when we were, I'll say early high school, late middle school. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right, Patrick?
Yeah. Well.
And that's when, you know, all, you know, everybody's decided the video games was going to ruin children. Now, since they've had all kinds of studies showing that video games can be phenomenal for kids, both in a thinking process and things like that. Heather, do you find yourself outside of the activity that your son's doing with your husband, which is completely different than just your kids sitting playing video games, right? That's an activity that they're doing together. Do you put limits on any type of gaming with your son or even with your daughter who's younger?
Yeah, well, she likes to sit there and cheer them on, you know, and she'll warn them when the bad guys are coming, which is really cute. So I think it's just sort of the technology piece that I try to limit, you know, and they're really getting into it. And so it's kind of, you want them to enjoy the flow state and the social time. And then I'm kind of the bad guy on the sidelines, like, you're 30 minutes in and that's probably enough right before bedtime.
Do you find yourself, Patrick, limiting like actual video game time?
Yeah, we limit stuff like that. I think it's different. I think it's different for every kid. The barometer I have with my kids is, how are they with social interactions with other people and with adults? And, you know, they are just, they're unbelievably social. It's like equal time. You can play games and then you got to go outside and run around like an idiot. Otherwise you're going to drive us all nuts. So my backyard looks like a jungle gym.
when we think of skill sets that we have as adults, I'd be curious, starting with you, Heather, are there things that you have now as an adult, things that you utilize either professionally or as an adult human being interacting with other adult human beings, that you can trace back and think, you know, it was because of play that I got better at this, because of interactions in a playful environment or anything like that? Have you ever tried to trace that back at all?
We were an Army family, so we moved around a lot, and often my brother was my main playmate as we were adjusting to the new neighborhood. And I definitely think, you know, I was able to navigate social situations just by kind of my experience one-on-one with him. You know, siblings always squabble, but you have to go through that to problem solve and figure out, you know, well, I have to live with this person, so, you know, we better figure it out.
Yeah. Well, so you moving several times, I guess, growing up, it sounds like, did you find, what methods did you do as a child or as a young adult to make new friends? Did you use play at all to do that? Or, you know, did you find yourself maybe not establishing yourself at each of the locations? I'd be curious to know that transition as you started to make new roots over and over again.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it always started out with my brother, and then we would meet neighborhood kids. I used to go fishing with one of my neighborhood buddies, so that was our play. And then as I got older, I became a dancer. I would go to dance classes with my friends from school, and that really became my source of play as sort of an older child into when I was a teenager. And as an adult, I've taught dance and have been a dancer, so you know, I think it went from, well, all my friends are doing this dance class and we're kind of playful and we, you know, run around during the dance class to music. But then it evolved into my source of play as an adult.
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm struggling with it has to do with a structured aspect. And what made me think of this is you mentioning the dance classes. My wife grew up in a very structured environment compared to what I grew up in. So for her, it was, you know, she grew up soccer practice, piano lessons, and gymnastics on the weekends, and boom, 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 where I didn't have any of that as a kid. If I showed an interest in something, I would be, you know, my parents would let me go do it, but it was not, this is what Thursdays are, this is what we do on Wednesdays, this is what we do on Saturdays. And there's a little bit of a tug and pull happening with my wife and I, because I love the fact that my daughter is learning piano and gymnastics and all of these things. And if it was left up to me, she would, you know, probably wouldn't be involved in any of that. So thank God for my wife pushing it. But at the same time, I also am trying to balance that out so that we don't are not over scheduling things. Is that a struggle at all in your house, Heather?
I'm of the school of thought that the less structure, the better. My son does learn martial arts, but my daughter's three, you know, some of her peers are already involved in all these extracurricular activities, but, you know, they have school all day. That's structure enough. And when they come home, they just want to be free. And I want to allow for that space. You know, as they grow up, their whole life is going to be scheduled. So this is really the time where they just need to relax, you know, have time to play with each other, to spend time as a family. And there's plenty of time for that later on.
I'd be interested, Patrick. I know, you grew up in a similar environment that I did, where our parents barely put up with us, let alone scheduled us for things. Is that something that you and your wife are dealing with or thinking about? Or is there any tug and pull happening there?
We need to find some. I think the idea here is that they're both going to have to find something that they're going to go learn very well. I don't even care what it is. And Emerson's temperament is different than mine. So it's probably going to be different than a thing that I would do. And Abby's temperament is, you know, it's just different. Like, I don't know. But I think that there is, who was it who said this? It was one of the guys from Mythbusters. He said, and he probably stole it from somewhere, but I heard it from him, which is, to be good at, you got to be good at one thing before you can be good at things. Do you know what I mean? Like, so I think that's almost as important as school, which is you have to really, like, it could be gymnastics. It could, you know, but you should really bust your ass at something to figure out what it takes to get good at it so that you can translate to other things in later life.
Do you find yourself pushing Emerson in that direction to say, Emerson, we need to find something, or are you kind of letting it happen?
Yeah, well, it's out there. It's like it, and it might not even be yet, but otherwise, you know, he's really sort of content to sit around the house. I think it's very important for people in general to have time to be bored, mm-hmm. but especially kids, because boredom is where creativity comes from. As you know, I mean, you and I, same. Like, we were bored, we had to come up with things to do.
Yep.
And I also think that you have to have one of the critiques about school changing class every hour that I read was really good. Was it said it's almost a system designed to keep people from depth, right? To really get immersed in something and go after it, and that's bad. But you gotta have time to be bored. I actually think it's because my son will mope around being bored, and we'll be like, yeah, good job. We'll let him be bored for a while, and we'll see if he can figure something out. And he does, and that's great.
Yeah. And I got to say that for me, I think one of the single qualities, if I had to boil down one single quality that's brought me the most success professionally, it's been my creativity. Because that has, for me, has been a differentiator between the other people I'm competing against, right, in the workforce, the ability to do that. And I attribute that to play. How about for you, Patrick? Is there things that you can say right now, it's because of playing D&D with me when we were 13, that you think matters now?
Yeah. I definitely think that the play and the boredom, and to bear this out, I mean, like, you think about some of the people that you're up against in the workplace or up against or work with, you know, that, some of the people are just like insanely impressive people, and maybe they're not very creative. They're very brilliant, but they don't have that thing. We have a family friends who moved out to Seattle, and you know, they're just surrounded by absolute genius, you know, Microsoft kids, you know, all this very successful, brilliant. And the parents, I always ask them, your kids are so creative, what do you do? And the mom says, well, I just threw them in the basement. But like, if you think about what role playing gets you, or, and that's partially acting too, you know, so I did a good bit of that, and the skills that gives you imaginatively, you know, to like, there's just a lot that you get from games. I don't want to downplay, you know, there's a lot of the physicality, but I mean, you and I grew up running around outside too, playing games, which there's a tremendous amount of brain development that happens there.
And you can do that and suck at sports, which is what you and I were.
Well, that was another reason. That was another genesis for Roughhouse Play, because it's gotten to the point where unless you are a perfect specimen,
right?
A perfect athletic specimen, you can't even play on a team, mm-hmm. right? Unless you're the right size. And that's not what games are supposed to be. And there's a whole history of traditional children's games that people would play that everyone could play. Like Foursquare is a great example. I don't care who you are. You could be missing a leg. You could not have legs and you could play Foursquare with anybody else in the world and everybody would have a good time and you can run around, you develop strategies, all that stuff. You can't play basketball unless you're a certain shape or size. And that's just not what the hell basketball was invented for. It was invented for physical education to get kids up and moving. And now it's totally different. So,
well, yeah. And it kind of gets to what I think we've been hinting at, all three of us, which is that the potential that things have gotten overstructured, right? And over prescriptive. So guys, let's take another break. When we get back from this break, I want to make a bit of a transition, which is where we're headed already, which is talking about play as adults, both as what the impact of play as children has on adulthood and playing as adults. So we'll be right back.
Howdy friends, Craig here. You deserve a new playmat. Here on the third floor, we use Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, almost free of glare, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. You pick a mat, pick a design, and then you pick an overlay, like one for Marvel Crisis Protocol, Star Wars Legion, or even Malifaux 3rd Edition. Those overlays will really speed up your deployment and make the placement of objective markers so easy. Use our promotion code in the show notes to get a 10% discount on your first order. In the notes of your order, you can even request the third floor logo on your mat for free. That makes the best mat in the business even a little better. So get some new mats, save yourself some money, and help support the show. Go to matsbymars.com. All the details are in the show notes, including the discount code.
Hi, I'm Keith Suderman, and I'm a patron of Third Floor Wars. You'll never mistake me for a competitive player, but I really enjoy the analysis and the advice I get from Tabletop Talk. You should be a patron too. Head on over to patreon.com and search for Third Floor Wars, or just click the link in the show notes below.
What is it worth to you to get this podcast on a weekly basis? Is it worth $1 a month? $5 a month? $20 a month? If you'd like to help support the work that we're doing here on Third Floor Wars, please go by our Patreon. We're at patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. There you can pledge at any level, any dollar amount. Whatever you give us will help us put out quality content on a regular basis and hopefully make tabletop gaming a little bit better for you every week. When we created our Patreon, we purposely did not create tiers. We wanted listeners that wanted to support us to be able to choose any level. But I do want to give a shout out to those patrons that donate the most per month. So special thanks goes to Nick Westbrook, Marcus, Craig Chuba, Kevin Smith, Mike Schmidt, Cody Ravicki, Drawn X, Sergey, Carl Lee, Corwin Solez, Alan Brown, Ambrose Ingram, Stephen Morris, Sam Newman, and James Hahn. Because the amount of money that you support us with each month, we're able to put out this content on a regular basis. Thanks a ton. So we were headed this way before the break, and really it kind of gets to the heart of where all of this idea of this episode came about, which is, you know, play as adults. Because as we go back to the
definitions that we had at the very beginning, which Patrick was a huge fan of. Both of those definitions focused on, you know, play as a child activity or an inconsequential activity. Because I put out this podcast, I think play as adult is very important. It's a big part of my life. It always has been. And I've returned to it several different times. So I'd be curious, starting with you, Heather, I know Patrick plays games because I know Patrick, but do you as an adult, you know, have people over and play games? Are there games that you and your husband play? Do you consider yourself a quote unquote adult gamer at all?
I would not describe myself as a gamer. But when quarantine happened, we every week put on a Zoom pub quiz. He runs a martial arts business. So one way to keep the group cohesive was to have a weekly pub night, which is what they did physically before COVID happened, but then just took it digitally. And, you know, I'm normally home with the kids on Friday night, but that allowed me to participate. And it was great fun to be a part of that. So I wouldn't say I'm a video game player, but I do like the sort of trivia intellectual games.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So he has, you know, he's already established a pod, a group, right, through with the shared interest of the martial arts, but sought out a game as a way to bring the group together in a different way. And it's actually brought you in as well. So that's interesting. I'd be curious to know, you being an outsider to a certain degree and being relatively new to this group, what do you see as the type of interactions or what's being gained by this group of people that already get together for martial arts, but yet do this as well?
I mean, the pub, the game, it was just sort of an excuse to have the social glue remain intact. And I know all these people, they're great people. They're like my big brothers and sisters, and I was just there for the sarcastic commentary.
Now, I found out during the break, and I didn't realize this, that you spent a bit of time in Japan, living in Japan. I'd be curious to know, you know, culturally, both as children, as adults, how gaming, what you saw different as far as gaming and play.
Yeah. It was different, in my opinion. Gomenasai, if I, culturally offend any of my Japanese friends. I felt that games there were a lot more structured. Just as an example, we used to attend the local baseball games. We lived in a town called Kashima City, and there was a very famous baseball team there called the Kashima Antlers. And the way of supporting the team was incredibly structured. There were chants that everyone had memorized. You know, there was a certain prescribed way to do every piece of the game, not just playing the game, but how to support the game. And it was an amazing spectacle.
That's so crazy, because an American baseball game, you could literally stand up and yell anything and it would be okay.
I know, the more disorganized, the better here, I think.
And do you think that that's telling? I mean, in your mind, what's that reflection? Is that a situation where you think that the culture has impacted the play, or has that been a something that's bubbled up because of the how structured play is? Because, you know, do you see that as a societal afterthought?
Yeah, I feel like it's more of a reflection of the culture. There's very much prescribed in Japanese culture. There's, you know, in a certain situation, this is the thing you must say. In a certain situation, this is the gift you must give. This is the amount of money you must give. And so when you play a game, this is the cheer you must say. So there's comfort in that. And the Japanese are certainly creative people, but I definitely think the way games are played there is a reflection of this. There is something for each situation.
Mm-hmm. So Patrick, one of the things that I have a lot of different people on the podcast. And one of the traditional question I ask somebody, because typically the people I have on are involved in games, either they're in the industry or they're experts at a particular game or something like that. And usually my first question is, you know, how did you get into gaming? And the typical story, you know, will be, you know, founded as a young adult, 10, 15, somewhere in that age, played all through high school, a little bit in college. Then I left games. Right. Stopped playing games altogether. And then late 30s, early 40s came back and found it again. How about for you, Patrick? I mean, you played a lot of games. Obviously, we did in high school and bled into college as well. Did gaming leave you and then come back at all? Or has it always been a part of your life?
I don't know. I guess it would depend. You know, there's a game can encompass a lot of different things. Like I would argue, because I know what you do with belly dance, Heather. I would argue that that's a game. Everybody's playing a game, especially the way that you've explained the way that you guys do it. That's a game. Like play encompasses a lot of things. I guess, you know, there's for me, I guess what brings me back to it and the value that I see in it now is more than any one game is that as everybody seems to become more isolated and there are these forces pulling us apart, getting a group of people together to interact, you know, and play a game. Now, sometimes like you get people together and it doesn't matter. You can just sit there and everybody talks so well and has something to say and they get along, but you know, you don't always have that, that social fabric there. And I think that a game is just a great way to start to build that and take all the pressure off the interaction. So you can, it's like, cause I do the same thing with Emerson. We'll sit there and we'll play a video game and he'll talk to me because we're not face to face, you know, and he'll open up in ways that he doesn't when we're, you know, both looking at each other. So I guess that's kind of what brought that back. And then there's also an element, I don't know what to call this, but, do you remember that god-awful quarter-stealing game Gauntlet?
Yeah. That's Sean and Glenn's favorite game at the moment.
Warrior needs food.
Warrior. So we played that game, and like I would play with like one quarter, and that game was just designed to separate you from your money. It's worse than a slot machine because your health was the amount of quarters you put in. And I was, you know, I didn't have any more quarters. I was a kid. I didn't have any really money of my own. And I always made a vow that one day I would find that machine in a dark alley with rolls and rolls of quarters and just beat it. And then, of course, you know, you can get a simulator and you can play it. Now you're like, this game is terrible. Why would I waste my time on this? But the principle is like we wanted to do things and play games that we couldn't do or we couldn't get all the supplements, you know, for. And now we could get everything. You know what
right.
I mean? It's like,
yep. So there's a different level of scarcity, right?
Yeah, well, it's not you're in control and you can get things. And there's so many more, you know, there's so many other great games now, too.
So I'd be curious, Patrick, because I remember it. I don't remember how long ago it was this happened. I remember you sending me a picture on my phone of you discovering the game Gaslands.
Great game, yeah.
You and your buddy, it was Brandon, I think, that you were
Brandon
playing with.
Right across the street. And yep. We gave. So
where did that come from? So like at some point you said, you know what, I'm going to go and explore. Someone finds it and it becomes a thing that the two or three of you do. Can you kind of walk me through how that happens?
I found it. I think I read about it on Boing Boing and I was like, man, that sounds great. And the, you know, the book was. So, you know, obviously, you know, miniature games, you know, they can be very expensive. And this one's just like, hey, you got a matchbox car? You want to do something stupid? Like, and the game's hilarious because the physics of the game and the interactions, they just get so out of control. But you can customize the thing to your level of, and that became really fun. But I found it and I was like, this is cool. We should play this. And the other guys jumped in. And then of course, you know, Brandon had to ruin it for everybody, but just, guy's artistic skills are off the chain. he made antennas by taking little pieces of plastic and melting it with a lighter and pulling it out so it'd make these whip antennas. Like, yep. My God.
And that ruined it for you, did it, Patrick?
No, it was just like, I can't even, like, I was feeling pretty good about painting this thing. And now I'm like, okay, fine, you win. I guess I'll put a sillier turret on this. I don't know what I'm
So, one of the things that is often discussed on this show is the analog nature of tabletop gaming. So whether it be role-playing games, miniature games, board games, and it's something that I attribute that I like is the analog nature of it. How about for you, Patrick? I mean, is there the ability, because you spend a lot of time on the computer just like I do, mm-hmm. even though we're in completely different works. Is there value that you find in unplugging and having an activity that you can do that doesn't involve staring at a screen?
Yeah, I stare at a screen too much. Just too much. It's just nice to move objects around. It's nice to, you know, paint something, carve a piece of wood. I like the physicality of things. You move the thing. Like you could say that, like take something simple like checkers. There's no difference between playing checkers on a computer and playing on a board across from somebody. It's a totally different game. It's a totally different game. It's not really enjoyable for me to play certain games online.
So Heather, I'd be curious what your thoughts are. Patrick obviously has been involved and still involved in the advertising industry. And I was, my wife worked for an advertising agency. I remember the first time I went to the office where she worked, and it looked like Adam Sandler's apartment in one of his movies. There was, you know, video games up here and a foosball table there. And, you know, it was kind of at the time where it became fashionable to have play at work. Mm-hmm. And that concept of, you know, ping pong tables and, you know, open areas for that to happen. It's come in and out of fashion since there. Do you have any thoughts about, you know, play at work and whether that has any importance at all?
Yeah, I think it can be a positive thing in certain fields. You know, if your field is being creative and developing ads, and, you know, I think it makes sense if you need to, you know, work with someone, play a game, tap into your creativity, and that will come out in your work. Other types of work, I feel like a more quiet, focused environment would be preferable. But there are kids growing up in a very distracting world, and so that may now be their new normal. You know, that may be what they're seeking out in terms of a workplace. So they may feel more comfortable in a very noisy
Chuck E. Cheese's
yeah, environment like that.
What did you see, Patrick, having been in the industry and worked in an advertising agency or office similar to what I described? Did you find that as a good thing, a bad thing, a little bit of both?
Well, I think anytime you do really intense knowledge work, I think there's a couple of things. One, you only get 2 to 3 hours of real focus a day, no matter who you are. I've had that experience played back to me from people across a lot of different disciplines in industry. And they're like, yep, yeah, that's all you get. To reset the brain, it's good to go do something else. So for me, creatively, and I wouldn't even just say creatively, because, you know, people who are doing very intense knowledge work. You have to take a disciplined break, really. Right. So you have to step away from it to give your subconscious time to process what you're working on, but you have to be very disciplined about going back to it. So that makes, you know, that's kind of the function that play serves there. What, the other thing that I saw, which is we would always play games. So the problem, one of the biggest problems in the modern world is, boredom, right? You just get bored. We would play games to alleviate boredom all mm-hmm. the time, and it wouldn't really matter. So, there's this guy I know. He was an account lead, and he would, every time they would go to present to these dull clients, he would hand out words to people, and there would be like, or they would all have a word, and the last person to use the word in the meeting and not be noticed would lose and have to buy drinks.
Nice.
You know, and you know, but you couldn't let on, you couldn't, that there was a game. So, and they were always, you know, kind of strange or difficult words. But that's a way to take something that's, you know, boring and you're not interested in. All of a sudden, boom, we're alive. We got a game. We're playing a game here.
Well, and now boredom does a different thing now. Now we've got filler for that, right? Because now it's Heather, when you see someone gets bored, what they do is not sit down and grab a book or do anything like that. They grab their phone, right? And they start flipping through their phone and having that activity zero calorie activity. Heather, is that something that you battle with yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I like to say that I am not on my phone 24/7, but, you know, we all do it. It's very addicting. But I there's absolute value in just sitting with yourself and not distracting yourself. And the same is true for children. You know, they're growing up grabbing a device in the same way we are. And a lot of parents don't want their children to be bored because that's when trouble happens. God forbid there's a spare moment that they're sitting idle. But that's taking away an opportunity. You know, distraction is a lost opportunity to create something new. And be with people. So it's definitely a disadvantage.
So I feel like, and this is going to be Craig's an old man speech here for a second, so put up with me. I feel like something changed, right? Because I remember as a kid, God forbid if I said to my mom or dad, I'm bored, because that would just be get out of my face, right? They would get out of go find something to do. Get out of here. But I know what you're saying, Heather, is that there seems like there's been a transition where, you know, now you can't let your kid get bored, right? You have to keep your kid stimulated. You have to keep your kid engaged in something. Do you have a sense of how, well, first of all, am I right? Has there been a change, or is that just old man Craig remembering something that really hasn't changed at all? And if it has changed, do you have any kind of sense of why it changed?
I agree with you. So I'm old lady Heather all the way on that one. I can't really pinpoint why it's changed, but I imagine just the availability of ways to distract children, you know, whether it is electronics or whether it is, you know, all the extracurricular activities or camps that are available. You know, we used to have 3 months of wide open summer where we were making mixtapes and listening to Casey Kasem's Top 40 and, you know, being out in the cul-de-sac, you know.
Yep.
And now, you know, there's never a free moment of looking for something to do.
When you were teaching Montessori or even a Tinker Garden, did you find parents of the kids you were teaching struggling with the somewhat unstructured nature of Montessori?
I mean, I think the good thing is that people are realizing this is happening and that now they're seeking out ways to be with their children or involve their children in open-ended structured play. So, you know, they're signing their kids up for classes like Tinker Garden, which is on the calendar. But then they can go and have an hour of creative problem solving, messy play. So I think just the awareness is building that there's been a shift, and all these parents that grew up in the ways we did are kind of reminiscing and wanting that again for their own children.
So Patrick, how about for you? We were perfect, right? The structure that we had and how we grew up, I mean, is the way everybody should have grown up. But I mean, in your mind, when did it change? How do we fight it?
This is a great question. And I think if you want to fight something, you have to be pretty precise about the definition of the problem.
Okay.
But let me answer the only things that I can guess. And like, this is a complex thing. Complex events don't admit of one cause, right? So
I need you to oversimplify it, Patrick. Come on.
It's the Russians.
There you go. Thank you. go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but you know, we're a lot, the role that kids played, like you can't take away the fact that infant mortality rates you know, are totally different than they were 100 years ago. People would have kids. They would have a lot more kids, right? Families would be larger. And you kids raised themselves, right? The whole structure of having a family and what it meant to be a parent, and the fact that you would lose, a large family would lose several children guaranteed, like up until recently. So parenting was very different.
Yeah, but we're not that old, Patrick. It's not like kids were dying left or right when you and I were a kid. I'm talking about the transition from our generation.
I know. I'm getting to that. So then what you have is you have people are having fewer children. So each child is more precious.
Okay.
Right. And the nature of parenting in extended families has changed. So parenting's very different. And that was happening with us. Like my grandparents were nowhere around. Like when I was growing up, like we didn't have an extended family. You didn't have an extended family around. And that's also very different for most of humanity in terms of, you know, child rearing and raising. And now we have the ability to monitor and constantly be in touch. Like some questions that come into this are like, how do you develop an executive function or really strong decision-making skills on your own when at every second you can go ask somebody else, or you can text them, or you can look up a thing, right? What does that mean for problem-solving skills? So these are all changes that have really been coming that are huge that nobody thinks about. I think that for a variety of reasons, we overprotect children now, and we don't expect enough of them. We don't give them an adequate amount of danger. One of the things that I talked about with Roughhouse was, if you pad a playground, you don't make kids safer. You just shift the risk off campus, right? Because gravity and concrete are facts of life. And I'm not saying that kids should play on broken knives, but I'm saying that if you're doing things for liability's sake rather than the development of the child, you're going to run into a problem somewhere there,
right?
That's very different. What are some examples? Like Farragut, the guy wound up being the admiral. I heard a story about him that at 14, the captain was shot off the deck of the ship and is a midshipman. Like, just look up what midshipmen did at 14 years old.
Yep.
In like, he commanded a ship of the line in battle and won. Like, we can expect a little bit more from kids at a younger age. And then the other thing that's happened is there appears to be, to me, this gap between, you know, it's sort of adolescence, right? Adolescents are useless. They know they're useless. We don't ask them to do anything. They don't have a useful role to play in society. They're kind of like senior citizens, right? We just want to lock you away until you change to your next state. Like, it's so that's another thing that's very unnatural in terms of history, right? So like, how do you, I mean, maybe some of the problem was, I mean, that was the way was when we were growing up. Like, we didn't necessarily have, although we had jobs.
Yeah.
But now, like, you know, how do you know, even as a teenager, right? You know whether you're useful to anybody else or not. And if you're not, it eats your soul.
Yeah. So,
sorry, that's probably a bit more of an answer than you were looking for, but. What? I got on a soapbox, damn it, not old.
I figured I'd inspire that.
I think part of, you know, making playgrounds so safe or situations so safe for kids, you're taking away an opportunity for them to develop any kind of resilience. Mm. So, you know, there's no reason for them to seek out an activity in the first place because they're all just handed to them. But there's no reason to persist at something, you know, if there's someone always there to step in and solve the problem. You know, they're, again, not given that opportunity to really let it play out as an experiment. You know, if you don't learn these ways of solving problems as kids or to, you know, really develop a sense of resilience in a little bit of a tough situation, then that's certainly going to lead to adolescents and young professionals never really launching in their careers.
Well, there's a lot showing up in the data about anxiety and neuroses in young adults and suicide rates. I did that essay on Hope podcast, and like fully 50% of adults 18 to like 30 have admit to having seriously contemplated suicide in the last 30 days. and the suicide rates are up, and there is a lack of resilience. There's something going wrong with our young people.
Well, I mean, it comes down to, and I think I've talked to you about this, Patrick, is this feeling that we can't let our kids fail. Lord knows my parents let me fail several times all the time.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, it's something that I'm trying to do with Cecilia is to make sure that it's okay. It's okay that it didn't happen. And it's something that, again, not to, boy, everybody listening to this is going to send their kids to Montessori by the time we're done, Heather. It was something that I loved about Montessori was, you know, when I was observing and I saw my daughter struggling, my first parental instinct was to help. And I loved the fact that didn't happen. Right now, Obviously, if she sought out direction, she would get it. But it wasn't she was allowed to fail. And it's something that it is a conscious thing that I try to make sure that I'm still doing and maintaining for that. But Patrick, that gets back to what you're talking about in the resilience piece. You know, and it's not something that really we saw at our age, but my sister as a teacher saw it, which is, you know, the kid gets a D. Now, when I got a D or a C in my case, because I never got D's, but when I got a C, like my ass was grass for lack of a better, like I was in trouble. I was grounded for an extended period of time. And I remember when my sister started teaching, her telling me that, you know, when she would give a C, the parents would come in and try to negotiate it out, try to figure out what was wrong in the classroom that led to my child getting a C. And that gets back to your point, Patrick, which is this inability to allow failure.
Or to let kids have, like, I don't think that kids should enter into contracts. I'm not saying that. But these are people. They have agency. Like, they have to be, I forgot what it was, but it was something with our oldest. And he was doing something in school. And Christy's like, what are we going to do about this? I'm like, I'm going to talk to him about it. But he's going to make his life as hard as he wants to make it. And there's nothing, like, you're going to have to, like, buddy, that's not, like, at some point, it's out of our control. He's going to have to choose to do something else.
Have you seen your oldest, Heather, head down a path and you've kind of wanted to nudge him and help him out a little bit, but you're able to kind of let it happen?
My son is kind of a Buddha child. All of our friends say, you know, like, this isn't fair. You know, he's always been very calm. And I attribute that to just taking him outside a ton when he was a kid. But his sister is paying us back in dividends. She's much harder work. I wouldn't say, you know, I've had to worry about him heading down a path of making poor choices. I think I worried more about, you know, I don't want him to be the recipient of something. That's my tender mom heart. But right. As a teacher, I know that he has to experience some hardships that way. You know, like if he's having a disagreement with his friends, or, you know, all of his friends are into this one ball game at school, but he doesn't want to play it. You know, he has to learn how to navigate. Well, if I don't want to play that game because I'm not good at it, I either need to spend some time figuring out how to play it better, or I need to choose a different group of friends who are playing something different. And so that was something that was pretty important to him last year. And we just talked about it. And, you know, he kind of knew he had those two choices. And in the end, he decided to team up with another friend, and they became expert fort builders on the playground. Nice. So, you know, he went through the middle and figured out his own way. Yeah. And not necessarily my own kids, but I see in the classroom every day, you know, I have 3 to 6 year olds. So that's a big age range. Yeah. And a big range of social development and emotional control. And so in any given day, we could be talking to a child about why it's not okay to bite someone or grab a toy, or, you know, here's what you say in this situation if someone's body is too close to your space, you know. So we're constantly offering language to our children that they can take and solve the problem themselves. And that's one thing I think you and Patrick, you and I have talked about before, Patrick, that when you founded Rough House, you know, you hated how the principals and the teachers kind of took the situation out of the kids' hands, you know, and robbed them of that opportunity to figure it out and solve their own problems.
I mean, I think my job, one of the ways I conceptualize my job as a parent is I'm not there to keep my kids from being hurt. I'm there to stop them from getting maimed. You know what I mean? Like I can't isolate them from the consequences of the world. I have to just give them the level of difficulty they can handle so they can figure out how to navigate it and be there as a safety net to make sure that doesn't perfect example is having a fire in the fire pit in the backyard and having a kid around fire. Well, I'm there to make sure you don't fall in. I'm not there to make sure you don't burn yourself a little bit because you have to do that to learn what fire is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yep. That's very, very true. Well, guys, I appreciate you taking the time and coming here. It was a kind of a nebulous subject right from the beginning, so I wasn't exactly sure where we were going to navigate to. But I like what we covered. And let's be honest, you know, this subject could be a doctorate for somebody at any point in time. Heather, is there anything before we go that you'd like to mention, plug, or give a shout out to?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing is what we talked about before. You know, games are great, but moderation is great. You know, take your game outside, get your kids fresh air, get them the physical movement, let them have freedom to solve their own problems. Definitely check into Montessori education and look up your local Tinker Garden classes.
I like it. How about for you, Patrick?
I just want to probably stress again that we don't understand what play is. Like you said, it's a good doctorate and having delved into that a little bit, like it's deep, it's old, it's very powerful. And anyone who underestimates its importance, either culturally or personally or is doing something foolish. And I guess if anybody wants more of my ramblings, I do have a pretty active presence at patrickemclean.substack.com. So.
Yep. And I will link to that. Patrick is putting out some good stuff there. Big fan of his podcast. And right now you've got a book that I think that my audience would be interested in. Can we talk a little bit about the book?
Okay. Yeah. So I wrote this, series called How to Succeed in Evil. And it's about a guy who's a consultant for supervillains. And he tries to help them be more villainous and profitable and efficient and all that stuff. But they don't listen because he's megalomaniacal. So I guess this would be the fourth book in that series. It's called Crazy Psycho Murder Tree. They're available as audiobooks. It's available on Amazon. It's available anywhere you might want to buy an audiobook. And then, yeah, there's a few of those. So it's Douglas Adams, Terry Pratchett type satire, loving send up of the superhero genre, which we both love so much.
Yeah, that we do. Well, guys, thanks again. And for those of you that listened to the end, thanks a bunch. Take care.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch so you don't miss the avalanche of content we create. Links are in the show notes. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest in gaming apparel and gear. There you'll also find the latest information for the U.S. Faux Tour. Find out where you rank in your conference or even in the entire United States. Get those models built, painted, and ready so we can see you at the next U.S. Faux Tour Masters event. Please take a moment to write a review of this pod on your favorite platform. Rating and reviewing helps us find more listeners almost as cool as you are. Be sure to share this feed with all of your friends who love tabletop gaming. Thanks for listening.
Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring, along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast.
Right. Nice natural transition.
So, Heather, I got a question for you. I don't know how you want to work this in, Craig, but since you lived in Japan, like, did you see any difference culturally there in play?
Well, shut up. That's a great question. I didn't know she lived in Japan. I got it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All right. <I'll...
laughs> And England, but I don't know. That's not quite as culturally different. Yes, there is a big difference.
So somebody, well, I mean, you just throw the U in the end of the word and flip the R and the E around. So I just got this job from a lady in London, and she asked me about being able to get people to do different voiceovers, you know, whatever, if I had talent. I'm like, yeah, I know, I source people from all over the world and we can do that. And I almost said, in fact, I know a guy who can do an absolutely incoherent Glaswegian accent. Her husband went to school in Glasgow. So he's
okay. Nice. Nice. All right. I'll bring us back. Very good. Very good. Thank you. We actually, this probably ended up being a short segment because we talked about a good bit of this, which is good. Is there anything specific that you think we should touch on?
Well, I don't think that definition of play is actually the dictionary definition, either the noun or the verb one, is actually very right.
Okay, good. We'll start there.
I don't even mean to be a contrarian. I just...
Oh, you just are. No, Patrick.
Sure, Patrick. Oh, Lordy. All right.
Feel attacked.
I'll bring us back. I have children between the ages of, you know, 3 and 7, all in the same room, just being self-directed and everything. It's incredible. But I completely lost track of what I was going to ask you. Damn it.
Hey, are you still here? Look, podcast is over, and you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, you might as well run over to patreon.com and become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast too while you're at it, on whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.
Two hunters are out in the woods when one of them collapses. He's not breathing and his eyes are glazed. The other guy whips out his cell phone and calls 911. "I think my friend is dead," he yells. "What can I do?" The operator says, "Calm down. First, let's make sure he's dead." There's a silence. Then a shot. Back on the phone, the guy says, "Okay, now what?"